Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. I hope everybody had a fabulous Halloween on Sunday. I know that we did. Hopefully, everybody listened to our first annual special Suspense Magazine, Suspense Radio Halloween show, where we read three wonderful stories. But if you missed it, that's okay, because you can still go back and listen to it. All of our shows are archived. I'm your host, John Robb, and we got a great show for you again tonight. We're going to have two exciting authors on the air. We're going to have Alan Dershowitz, and we're going to have Jeff Sherratt come on. They're going to be talking about their books. It's going to be a very exciting time. So this is your time to sit back, go out, grab something to drink, whatever you got to get, because 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. Here on a nice Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday night, wherever you might be here, we're in Southern California coming to you live here on Suspense Radio. Again, I'm your host. It's great to have everybody on here. We've had a nice big surge of listeners coming and listening to the show, and it's great to always have new people to come on here and listen to us. You know, you can follow us all through Facebook. You can always go to our website at suspensemagazine.com. Very diligently right now. It's very difficult. Our creative team is butting through trying to get the best book here of 2010 into the publication, which is going to go to the printers quite soon, and it's going to be out there on the shelves. If you haven't picked up your November issue yet, shame on you. Why not? Because you don't have too much longer before, you know, they're going to pull that off and they're going to bring December's on. So you want to make sure you're out there and sell that out, because the more we sell, the more that goes off the shelves, the more they're going to get the next time, and that's more people that are going to be able to enjoy Suspense Magazine, everything that we bring, because we try extremely hard every week, you know, that we bring the absolute best in authors and information to you from the suspense mystery thriller horror genre. It's going to be a great show tonight, where we're going to have, you know, writer and famous lawyer on the air here, Alan Dershowitz, in about 10 minutes. We're going to do something a little different. I'm going to be calling him here live from the show. So, you know, we're going to see what happens. You just never know with live radio what's going to happen. So it should be interesting. I called him about an hour ago. Everything should be good. And then we're going to bring on Jeff Sherratt right after that. And, you know, Jeff is the author right now of Detour to Murder. And you're going to be able to listen to a little bit of, you know, his mystery novel. So, again, everyone, maybe listen to that and see what that was about, because we'd had a great time recording that show. I did a live in the morning about 8:30, and hopefully no one got tired of listening to my voice as I read those three gate stories that I had on the air. We had one by Chris Nadeau, we had one by Stephen Barnes, we had another one on there from Donald Allen Kirch. So I definitely encourage you to go back and check those out, because it's something that we're kind of testing to see how well people liked that type of a show, because maybe what we'll do here, instead of just bringing you authors and interviews twice a week, we might only do that once a week, and then we might go and be picking up some stories to read on the air, so you guys can, hear your stories. You can hear, different things. As long as I can keep talking and, I don't have to drink, which is what I'm doing now. So, excuse me. So it's a little warm, and things are, doing good. And I hear that I guess there's technical difficulties, which, I guess maybe seems to happen here with the internet that we've been trying to do. So hopefully I do know that things, come through. We're going to try to clean that up. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to change a little bit on what I'm doing. And, hopefully we can get, like I said, get those things cleaned up. But besides the point, we are still sitting here with our December issue coming out with our top, and it's going to be more in our top 10 books. We are doing a lot of different books, a lot of different styles. We are sitting there and doing, we're trying to break it down into different genres and, different things that we are going to do here. One second, if you could give me the other headset. So we're going to try flipping headsets here. I keep hearing that I'm going in and out. So we're going to see if this helps. But like I said, the genre that we're going to be covering, and it's going to be across the board, where we're going to be talking about mysteries. We're going to be talking about cozies. We're going to be talking about dark urban fantasies. We're going to be there's going to be political and legal and medical. So because there's so many great books, it's very difficult. We had such a tough time last year breaking that down into the top 10 that we wanted to go ahead and see if we could, change that up a little and, bring you more books. But we are going to take one in particular, and we're going to make it to where it's going to be, the top book here of the year. So you might have to bear with me for just 1 second, because I am going to be changing my headphones here, and hopefully that will alleviate any problems that we're going to have. So if you hear dead air, that's just me changing. So hold on 1 second.
So hopefully we're back. Hopefully we're back here on the air and everybody can hear me try changing everything. So I'm going to find this out. And we're going to see if hopefully this works a little bit better. And see if we can get all this to work. So again, I do apologize for the problems here that we're having. But, like I said, it is the internet. There's a lot of stuff that goes on. They're still trying to probably work out the kinks and everything else, but I do apologize with that. So I hear that you can hear me better. Our December issue's out there. Everyone, you have to go out and want you to go check that November issue. I want everybody to, send in your story, send in everything that you have. We're going to be doing a lot of different things here coming up for the next 2011 in January, and hopefully those things are exciting. But we're always looking for suggestions on everything to see if, how can we make the magazine better. And, we love to hear from the fans. We love to hear from, different people on exactly what we can do to make the magazine, a little bit better. So please go ahead, and email us at editor. Many different ways that they can get a hold of us and being able to be a part of Suspense Magazine, because we do this for you. If we did this for our health, we would die of old age a long ago. So, again, you know, I'm going to preference a little bit here and bring up that our first guest, and I'm going to bring him on shortly, it's going to be Alan Dershowitz, and his latest book is called The Trials of Zion, which came out in October. And before I do that, I just do have to make one more announcement that we're doing on Friday. This Friday, we are not going to be doing our normal show. It's going to be early in the day because David Balducci is going to be on, and I'm going to be having that show on 8 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. The only time I could get him was 11 o'clock Eastern time, a.m. in the morning. So there will be no Friday night show. It will be Friday morning again. But that's okay if you don't hear it live, because you can always go back and listen to the archive version. It's only going to be a half hour. We're going to do a special show here with David only. So, again, that's going to be Friday at 8 a.m. Time, 11 a.m. Eastern time. And then when you get home, you're going to sit there and listen to the show or download on iTunes, however you normally get it. So now we're going to be talking again about the Trials of Zion. We're going to have Alan Dershowitz coming up here. I'm going to be calling him in a second. But this is, again, this is his third book. His sort of fiction book. He's written many nonfiction books, many law, different kinds of books. And, of course, this is going to be another legal thriller, and this is going to be bringing back his character, Abe Ringel. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to give him a call, and I'm going to try to get him on the air. So let's see if we can get this to work. This is going to be very interesting. So, again, bear with me just for a second. You never know what's going to happen here on live radio. I'm actually kind of excited to see if I can get this to work. So here we go. Yes, you still
here,
Daddy. Hi, is this Alan?
It's Alan.
Alan, how are you doing? This is John with Suspense Radio. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's such a pleasure that we finally got a hook up. The last time it was a little bit different, and so it's so great to be able to hook up with you tonight and talk to you about your latest book, which is extremely exciting, The Trials of Zion.
Thank you so much. I'm excited about it, too.
Yeah, this is your third this is your third fiction book.
My 30th book of fiction.
Right. And it took you 11 years now to go from your last book, which you had, which was just Revenge, to now come up with Trials of Zion. Now, I didn't know if that was it a 10-year in the making, Trials of Zion, or was you just so busy you just couldn't have time to sit down and write another fiction book at the time?
Well, it took me about 3 years to write The Trials of Zion. It's a hard book to write. Novels are harder for me than nonfiction. Thrillers are very hard. And thrillers that have a historical background, I had to go to Israel, check out all the locations, make sure everything I had in the book could happen and has happened. And so it took me over 3 years to write it. And I also, you know, wanted to be sure this is the book I wanted to write, and very much did want to write it, and I'm very happy with the result. And so far, all the reviews have been sensational, and so the readers who've read it have enjoyed it, and it really makes it worthwhile to have spent so much time on a book.
Yeah, because, you know, the very exciting part is it's not only a legal thriller, but it is very much a historical thriller, which is kind of odd to kind of put those two genres together. You did it in such a great way that, I mean, with such an explosive kind of background, because you had a terrorist bomber, which, of course, you know, something which is very close here to not only Israel, which they have to deal with every day, but over here in the United States. So, you know, that doing it that way, I mean, that had to be, you know, kind of very exciting for you to go ahead and write a kind of book like that was so close to home.
Yeah, no, and, you know, I try to make it a rip from the headlines, realistic thriller, something that could really, really happen. Remember that when people have tried to make peace in Israel previously, they've been killed. Sadat was killed after he made peace with Israel and Egypt. And Rabin was killed when he was trying to make peace with the Palestinians. And King Abdullah's grandfather from Jordan, King Abdullah I, He was killed when he tried to make a peace with Israel. So, you know, I start the book, obviously, with people trying to make peace. They've finally reached the point where they can sign a peace treaty, and suddenly there's a terrorist attack, and world leaders are killed. And the book is a whodunit, and the whodunit seeks to trace the mystery through history. In fact, the mantra is history will solve the mystery. You have to know the history in order to solve the mystery.
And that's the great thing that you did do in the book, is that you did give that great history, you know, in there, in order for someone that's picking that up that might not understand, I guess, the chaos that goes on every day over in Israel, to be able to experience that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that it puts the person in the perspective of somebody, an American. It's a young American lawyer, a woman who just graduated law school, the daughter of a prominent American lawyer, who goes over to the Middle East, and her first job is to try to solve this mystery. And so she doesn't know very much about the Middle East. And so by educating her, the character, I try to educate the reader, and I try to do it in small doses. Obviously, this is not a history book. It's a thriller. I want it to be a page-turner, and so far many of the reviewers have used the term page-turner, so I'm happy. Short chapters, you know, quick, lots of turnabouts, kidnappings and trial scenes and nuclear threats and Iran and double agents and triple agents and you know, but realistic. I mean, every one of the characters is based on somebody I know.
And I heard another interview that you had done, and you said, you know, you kind of challenge anyone, since you said this is a whodunit, to try to figure out that twist at the end on what's going on. I heard you say that. You're like, I challenge anyone to get one.
But you're not gonna tell anybody on the air.
I'm telling
nobody.
You know, that's
the ending is very surprised. A lot of people have been shocked by the ending.
Right, because when you put, you know, a terrorist bomber, and I think that's Americans not only view today, is that as soon as somebody is labeled a terrorist, they're automatically found guilty. And I think that that's the difficult thing to get over, that stigmata, is that, no, people still are innocent until proven guilty, no matter what. And I think that's the great thing that you bring to here, is, you know, there always is that, you know, you have to still have that, you know, innocence, especially, you know, that's how you built your career. They're innocent
until
proven guilty.
This is much more complicated, because in this case, at least one of the people who is accused wants to be found guilty. Even though he didn't commit the crime, he's determined to become a suicide defendant, having failed to become a suicide terrorist. So it becomes even harder to defend somebody who you know or believe is innocent when he wants to be found guilty and become a martyr. And, of course, in the first trial scene in the book, the leading character has to find him innocent, otherwise he might lose his daughter. And so the stakes are very, very high.
Yeah, and that's, you know, page-turner is definitely a great way, is a great way to put it. And I do like the fact that, you know, you can find, you know, you on Facebook with the Trials of Zion, and you can also find Alan here at alandershowitz.com and check out all of his publications. Well, not all of them, because you've written so many, but exactly, you know, what you're talking about, and you can go back and read, because you brought Abe from the very one back in Advocate Devil.
Yeah.
And
the same characters recur. Abe, the lawyer, who some people think is modeled a little bit on me. He's a Boston lawyer. And, of course, Emma, the daughter. I have a daughter named Ella. And she started out as a high school student. She's now graduated law school, and she's growing up along with my readers. So I'm very happy. And, you know, you can actually, I think, see me on one of the Facebook or one of the others, I don't remember, reading the first prologue to the book. And get some sense about what the book's about. And I think it'll grab you, because, you know, it is a very dramatic scene with the world leaders about to sign a peace treaty, and then this terrible terrorist attack occurs.
Yeah, and again, in that same interview, you said that nonfiction was very easy to write because it's pretty much just a lot of facts, where fiction is much more difficult. What was your biggest struggle with writing the Trials of Zion?
Well, the Trials of Zion is the hardest book I ever wrote, because It involves twists and turns, and of course, writing a novel, a thriller, a mystery, a legal thriller, everything has to fit together. You know, in reality, when you're writing nonfiction, everything fits together because it really happened. But here you're making it all up, and everything has to work, everything has to fit together. And here, I combine that with the need to have an accurate history, accurate geography. Geography plays a role in this too, and I actually had to do all the trips that I describe in the book to make sure that you can, you know, get from point A to point B, and that it's all realistic. But mostly it's plotting. Mostly it's, you know, creating realistic characters. And one of the highest compliments I was paid by a reader after reading the book said, by the way, which side are you generally on the Israel-Arab or Israel-Palestine issue? You know, I've written books in the case for Israel, but you can't tell in this novel because I've made the Palestinian character very realistic. One of the heroes is a Palestinian Christian human rights activist. You can't tell by reading this novel that I generally am a strong supporter, sometimes a critical supporter, but a strong supporter of Israel, because I didn't try, as my son, who's a film producer, says, if you have a message, buy a billboard. If you want to tell a story, write a novel. So I wanted to tell a story.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have there's some questions that got emailed into us here when they knew you were on. And one of the biggest questions we always get is, because you do have such another big career that you do, is how disciplined must you be to find the time to be able to write your novels?
Well, I write every day. One way or another, I write every day. And writing is a passion for me. You know, people think of me as a public character in court or on TV. But my most productive part of the day is when I sit there with a yellow pad. I don't type or use a computer. So I sit with a yellow pad and a ballpoint pen, and I write. And I try to write, you know, 20 or 30 pages every day. When I'm writing nonfiction, it flows very easily. When I'm writing fiction, I have to tear it up. It doesn't work. You know, this book originally was 500 pages long. I got it down to 300 by brutal editing, because otherwise it was going to be much.
Now, was that your editing?
Not enough thrill. Huh?
Was that your editing or the publisher's?
Partly me, and partly I had a wonderful editor in New York who really, really made me cut stuff mercilessly. You know, you hate to see your own writing on the floor, but he was right.
Okay. And so you took a lot of that stuff apart and you said, okay, yeah, I guess I can move those things in and move those things out, which, it's always difficult. But from where you started to where it ended, how different did it change, and how many times did you have to take that legal pad and throw it up and throw it down and say, I got to start all over again?
Quite a bit. I had the beginning, I had the ending. But a lot of the stuff in the middle I really had to change. I had much more history. And my editor, who tragically, his name is Les Pockel, who tragically died just before the book came out, never got to see the finished product, you know, has a lot of responsibility for how it came out. He was a wonderful editor. He could have been a wonderful surgeon because he made me cut so much out. But I think it's much quicker, much faster read. You know, the pages really do turn. You don't get bogged down a lot in the history. There's a little history, but it's very relevant. The history is always related to the mystery. So, you know, it took me a long time, a lot of edits, a lot of changes, a lot of the middle. This whole second trial scene I hadn't planned. It just naturally grew out of the characters, and I really like the way it develops. And I went and sat in on Israeli trials to see the difference between the Israeli legal system and the American legal system, and I thought about how an American lawyer like me would exploit those differences if he were assigned or to represent somebody in an Israeli court. And so, you know, the lawyer uses every trick in the trade. The only problem is he has to trick his own client in this case, because his client wants to be found guilty and the lawyer wants him to be found innocent. So there's an additional kind of ethical twist.
And that just probably made things just, you know, a little bit more difficult for you to try to write. I mean, because you got to intertwine not just the main story, but all those little subplots that always seem to perk up, which make the story a whole.
Right, and they all have to hang together. They can't be really two plots to a book. It has to be, you know, maybe two intersecting episodes, but they have to, in the end, all work together toward producing the result. And it also has to, A, fool the reader. The reader has to be misled into thinking it's going to end one way and it's going to end another way. But then when it ends the way it ends, the reader has to be able to think back and say, you know, I should have figured that out. It was there for me to figure out. He didn't really fool me or trick me. He just temporarily deceived me, because all the elements have to be there. There can't be any irrelevant false leads or red herrings that are just designed to drive the reader away. Everything has to be relevant, and the reader at the end has to be able to say, gee, if I had just put this together earlier, I probably could have figured it out. All the clues are there.
Right. It's sort of one of my favorite movies was Murder by Death, where Truman Capote was always yelling at the people saying, you can't introduce characters in the last five pages of the book, and that's just not right. It can't do that.
Yeah,
so,
of course, in real life, that happens all the time. In real life, you know, you're trying to solve a crime, and suddenly something happens at the very end that you never anticipated, because, you know, real life and fiction, notwithstanding the fact that we say that life imitates art, it doesn't. Life is full of irrelevancies, and fiction can't have irrelevancies. I once won a case in court by showing that the person had been convicted based on a theory of fiction rather than a theory of reality. He had taken out an insurance policy on his partner in Act 1, and then the partner was killed in Act 2 by an unknown gunman. And, of course, in literature, he has to be guilty because he took out the insurance policy, but we proved that he wasn't guilty, and eventually we were able to determine that he was killed by unrelated gangsters to whom he owed money.
Wow.
So
I
really
mean, that's
happened.
Almost the book. Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of, you know, with so many cases that you've done, you know, winning 13 out of 15 murder cases, I mean, you have a lot of, you know, things that you've been through that you could write, you know, fiction books alone besides writing nonfiction books just on your work alone.
Yeah, and I have.
Great.
You have
a ton of material in your head.
Yeah, I wrote a book about the O.J. Simpson case. I wrote a book about the Klaus von Bülow case. I've written books about others of my cases, and I'm going to continue to do that because those come easy to me. It's the novels, the fiction, that are really hard. I think I have one more novel in me. But it's
one more fiction novel?
I hope so. I'm going to try, but it's not immediate. I mean, my characters are still young enough to have one more good story, but I'm not there yet. I have to figure it out.
So then that was going to be, you know, everybody always says, you know, what have you done for me lately? And, you know, now the Trials of Zion, and you get everybody so excited, and you got everybody so excited on Just Revenge back in 99, and they're like, I had to wait 11 years now. I don't want to wait 11 years again for the next one. So hopefully
years.
You got
too
more
old
than
for that.
One.
I've been doing the next five or six at least.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully you're going to have more than one. And, you know, how do you think, just on a self, you know, self looking back at yourself here as doing fiction, from 1994 when you wrote, you know, Advocate's Devil, now through your third Trials of Zion, how have you evolved as a fiction writer?
I think my characters are better. I think they're richer and fuller. In the first novel, I think my characters were kind of stick figure characters, just designed to help me make ethical points, because I was really writing the novels to show how difficult it is to make kind of moral decisions as a criminal lawyer. And now I think my characters have become fuller. I've learned better, particularly how to create female characters, which is very hard for a male to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think I've matured as a writer, but that's up to the reader to decide, basically.
And now, do you have like a fiction writer that you kind of read a lot that you were just, you know, that kind of made you decide, I'm going to do this?
I have a lot. I mean, I read a lot, and I wouldn't say there's a single one. I mean, I read everything from, you know, Dostoevsky to, you know, Richard North Patterson to David Mamet to Kafka to, you know, other writers. So it's not one writer who I try to emulate. I mean, one writer who I went back to for this novel, of course, was Leon Uris, who wrote Exodus back 50 years ago about the establishment of the State of Israel. But, of course, he wrote his book in order to make points about, you know, how wonderful Israel was. I didn't do that. I mean, I didn't want to write a book. I've written two books. I've written The Case for Israel, The Case for Peace. So I didn't want to write yet another book about that. I wanted to just tell an interesting story that helps to explain the conflict in the Middle East, why it's so difficult to achieve peace, but which has elements of optimism.
And you definitely, you know, and that's something that you've definitely done here. We recommend everybody definitely to go out. The Trials of Zion came out in October 2010. Like I said, it's available right here through Amazon. All your bookstores are going to have it. You can go to alandershowitz.com. You can click on the Trials of Zion. Takes you right to Amazon. Boom, download it to your Kindle. Bring it into your box because you're talking a great Christmas gift that, you know, going to be coming up. And, you know, buy 20 of them and give them to your friends because that's the great thing. You know, our fans and the people that read our magazine, very, very fickle fiction writers, and they don't like to be disappointed. And definitely your book, Alan, is not one that they're going to be disappointed with when they finish it. They might put it down and say, why did he trick me? And that's the good thing because when you get those emails, and I always tell people, if you know, writers, if you get those emails and they say, I hated that character or I loved that character or hated the ending or loved the ending, that means you've emotionally touched them. And that's the best compliment I think that you can get as a writer, that you have emotionally touched them inside with your writing.
I agree with that. And I love to get emails from my readers. And I've gotten a lot of emails from readers making suggestions of how to improve my next novel, what they think this character should be doing next. So it really means that they have seen the character as a real person, and I like that. You know, the biggest thrill that a writer can get, obviously, is to see his characters on the big screen. And my book, Advocate's Devil, was made into a made-for-TV movie. I think it was an ABC movie of the week, and I saw, you know, Mariska Hargitay, and I saw Ken Olin playing the characters I invented, and I said, oh my God, I invented these people, and
yeah,
they are on the screen. It was different than the movie Reversal of Fortune that was made out of my nonfiction book about the Von Bülow case, because those were real people. When I saw Jeremy Irons play Klaus Von Bülow, well, I didn't invent Klaus Von Bülow, but I invented Abe Ringel, and I invented Emma Ringel, and I invented Rendy, and I invented, you know, all the characters in Trials of Zion, and you know, I'd love to see them on the big screen. We already have some interest in it being made into a movie. So don't wait for the movie. Read the book. But
that's right. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm
and they can contact you right on your website, too.
That's right. Yeah, and I return emails when people write to me. So
sure.
I'm happy to be in a correspondence with anybody who's read the book about what they think.
So you get up about 4 a.m. and you go to bed about midnight.
I actually get up at about 7 a.m., and I usually go to sleep at 11:30. You know, I don't usually stay up late enough to watch Jon Stewart. So I'm early to bed, early to rise, basically. And but I try to write every single day. If a day goes by and I don't write, I feel disappointed.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, Alan, thank you so much again for joining us. It's been such a pleasure. You know, we look forward to the next one. Hopefully we don't have to wait, you know, 11 years and we can get back on it and, you know, talk about that one. So, again, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great night.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to have intelligent conversation on the radio. Good.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that's Alan Dershowitz, and that is his latest book here, The Trials of Zion. Came out in October 2010. You go to alandershowitz.com. Alandershowitz. Contact him. Read the book. Tell him what you think, because that's great that authors like to get, you know, back exactly what, you know, they like to get the contact. He's going to email you back. So let him know, you know, what you think of the book. You're not going to be disappointed. He's right when he says, he challenges you to guess what's going to happen, even though the clues are sitting right in front of your face. Sometimes that's the hardest to see. But I want to go ahead right now. I want to bring in our next guest, and hopefully I get his last name correct. We're going to find out, because everybody knows I'm not good at last names. So Jeff Sherratt, bringing him on here with his latest book, Detour to Murder. Jeff, how are you?
Fine, and you're very close on the last name.
Oh, I tried so hard.
No, Sherratt. That's okay. Sherratt, exactly. There you go.
Sherratt. Yeah, you know, I'm terrible at last names. I'm terrible at first names. I'm surprised they didn't call you Jim. Sometimes I just screw those things up. I get so many names in my head, I'm just not sure what to do. But, hey, it's so good to have you on here and to be able to talk about your book, which you call a film noir mystery novel,
right.
Detour to Murder. Can you gotta, you know, tell the fans a little bit about Detour to Murder, maybe how it came about, you know, your thought behind it and those types of things?
Exactly. I write Jimmy O'Brien mystery series, which is set in Southern California back in the 70s. And my character, the protagonist, is a guy by the name of Jimmy O'Brien. He's a youngish criminal defense lawyer with a little storefront office, no clients, very little money coming in the door. And he gets most of his cases are handouts from the government. For example, he goes to arraignments and so on. You know, they give him $50. They say, you go over there and represent this guy at his arraignment and make sure he pleads guilty and go home. But in this case, we decided I have a new publisher, Zova Books, a great group of people. And I've been milling around this concept of a film noir series. And basically what that means is that I'll take an old film noir movie that ended, say, in 1945 or was made in 1945 and take it forward maybe 30 years so that it's in, you know, in the 70s again and come up with a resolution to it. In this particular book, Detour to Murder, I use the film Detour, which is an iconic film noir, probably one of the worst movies ever made, if the truth is known. You know, it was made on a skimpy budget, and the director, as they were filming it, I think it was shot in 6 days, actually, and as they were filming the movie, he was literally tearing pages out of the script. The original script was about 2 hours, and the movie came in at an hour and 6 minutes. So there was threads going nowhere, loose ends all over the place, and the resolution at the end is absolutely absurd. But when the movie was 28 years later, the copyright was up for renewal. The studio that filmed it was out of business, and nobody bothered to renew the copyright, so it fell into public domain. And at that point, these used car dealers were starting to show their all-night movies on television, and they could play this film over and over again without paying a royalty. So it played in, I'm sure, all over the country, but in L.A. Area quite a bit. And I think it was like, for example, kids in college, you know, in their dorms. They might have been smoking something, who knows, but they came up with a concept that, this is, you know, you have to really listen to the voiceover in the movie. It's existentialism. There's a lot of philosophy here. Forget about what it's saying and so on. And Siskel and Ebert, about 10 years later, actually, when they were on PBS, reviewed this movie and gave it 2 thumbs up and more or less implied that if you're not bright enough to understand the real meaning, the depth behind it, that, you know, you won't get it. And unbelievably, about 10 years after that, the Smithsonian Institute picked it as one of the most 100 influential American films. So anyway, I've seen the movie dozens of times, and I was talking to my editor, Mike Sirota, about it one day, and I said, wouldn't it be interesting if we could actually take the hero of the movie, or the protagonist in the movie, the anti-hero, and have him in prison out here in Southern California at the Chino Institution for Men, 30 years later, and he's up for parole. Now, my character, who does these government low-pay type of things, would go out there to interview him. He gets the gig from the state or whoever. They give him $100 and say, go out there and, you know, represent this guy through his parole hearing. And that's how it starts. And we go forward from there. We bring in a little bit of the movie in the first part of the book, you know, several pages to kind of explain, you know.
A little backstory,
a little narrative on the movie. But I found out from people that have seen the movie and read the book, you know, the galleys and so on, that it's actually better if the readers haven't seen the movie, that they can, you know, read the book and then if they want, go back and get the movie and see what, you know, what these characters looked like in, you know, 1945 and so on.
Yeah, because then you don't kind of get jaded, and you kind of go into it with an open mind to be able to say, because this is basically, you would kind of say that this is almost the sequel 30 years later.
Right, exactly. And it's written in such a way that we pretend like the movie doesn't even exist. In fact, in the first chapter of the book, about the first or second chapter, he's interviewing the prisoner, Al Roberts, who is the character in the movie. And he says, what happened? You know, you confessed to it back in 1945. You confessed it's brutal murder. And now you're saying you're innocent. What's going on? He said, well, I really didn't have a lawyer. He said, they sold my story. My lawyer sold the story to a movie company. They made this crappy film called Detour. He took the money and split. You know, so that's the only actual reference to it. Now, I've got to be honest. There, in a few cases, there's some lines that are lifted directly from the movie. I've took some of the dialogue from the movie and used it in the beginning part, just a few, to give it that flavor. But basically, it's a whole new story. It takes off, and in doing this thing, when Jimmy O'Brien gets involved and opens his big mouth and says he'll take the case, Al Roberts doesn't have any money, either does Jimmy, so they're under little financial pressure. So he doesn't act like an attorney going to court and all this stuff. He's got to actually go out and solve the case. And in doing this, he has to look back at some of the activity that was going on in Los Angeles in the 40s and 50s and so on. And people that understand or are aware of Los Angeles history in those days will know that, it was terrible. L.A. was corrupt. It was controlled by the MGM.
No, L.A. was not corrupt.
Oh, how can we say that? Well, I live in Orange County, so I can say whatever I want about L.A.
We're doing this from L.A. too, so it's not like it was corrupt. It's still corrupt.
Well, yeah, but I'll tell you, it was in those days. It was amazing. Some of the research
back then. Yeah, it was worse than Chicago. I think they have to say this corrupt. I think L.A. had them all beat, but they were just a lot more white because there was no Al Capone and the gangsters.
Exactly. They had some of the notorious people that came out here. They worked actually for the gangs back in Chicago and in Cleveland, the Purple Gang in Cleveland, the gangs in New York, you know, the mafia groups in New York, for example. Bugsy Siegel, they sent him out here to work, they started this, what they call this wire service, which is, like the Associated Press or whatever, but it was basically set up to feed racetrack results to the book parlors all over the place. And in the 40s...
The first internet right there for books.
Yeah, you got it. You got that. It was totally illegal, and it was wide open. And you'd walk into, say, a candy store or something like that, and knock three times on the little door off to the side, and you'd open it up, and there'd be a full gambling parlor, race for racetracks. They'd have the live race results going and comfortable chairs, a little bar in the corner. And these guys paid for these live race results over a wire, over the telephone lines. And the people that owned these wire services obviously were gangsters. And what they did, in the old days, when you went to the racetrack, they locked up all the telephones. Once the race started, the phones were locked up until the race card was over. So they would have spotters, they'd rent an apartment building, apartment house across the street with a big telescope, and guys on the telephone calling the race, and they'd broadcast that to all these bookie parlors all over the place. And it was very lucrative. I mean, it was huge money, so naturally... the gangs got involved, and they had competing gangs, just like they did during Prohibition, and they would shoot each other and fight for that territory. And it was, when I'm doing the research, it was very surprising to me, although I had a hint of it before, on who owned these wire services, some of the names that you see. I in the book, I changed the names, okay, because I don't...
Yeah, you don't want to get the families mad at you.
No, I don't want to get sued. Some people know where I live, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but, you don't want to do that one. There's no mafia. No mafia. That's what I'm
exactly.
saying.
Exactly. And, if you look, I do a lot of book signings in Barnes & Noble and Borders and so on, and people come up to me, and I tell them, I said, well, if you watch PBS, for example, and they said, yeah, we do. And I said, do you notice before the show starts that it's, money is donated by such and such a foundation and so on? And they said, yeah. And I said, have you ever thought about who those people are, who their grandparents were and what they did for a living and how they made that kind of money? And, it comes out of my book. I did have to change some of the names.
Well, questions here that your fans have relayed to me is here. Here's the first one.
Okay.
Did you study film more to learn the nuances and adapt those for a modern audience?
Yes, actually I did. First of all, I'm old enough to remember when the theaters had two pictures, before television really took off. My father loved movies. He loved, musicals, cowboy movies, and gangster movies. He didn't go in much for melodramas and that sort of thing. My mother did. But we went to the movies. I have four brothers and sisters, and, you know, we go to the movies two or three times a week. And they would always play the major, you know, Singing in the Rain, the big musical. And then they'd have a cartoon and newsreel, a short subject, and the B-movie. And even as a little kid, you know, they didn't have ratings in those days. So, you know,
right. We'd
go in there. And I just loved it. I looked at films, I can remember at the Lemur Theater watching Out of the Past. So I didn't realize I was looking at art, shall we say, at that time. But later, you know, after I started watching all night television and watching these movies, I said, wow, there's something here. And that kind of sparked my interest in film noir and so on. Plus, I've been reading mysteries, you know, all my life, starting with The Hardy Boys and on up from there.
Yeah, and hey, I mean, when I was growing up, it was the original, you know, you got Scooby-Doo, Clue Cub, and Captain Caveman. So, you know, that's what I grew up with my detectives.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's kind of fun.
I couldn't guess all the time in Scooby-Doo who did it, and Clue Cub was tough, too. But I'm telling you, it was still fun to try when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old.
Exactly. You know, and believe it or not, people, when they want to ask me about writing, you know, how do you craft a novel or whatever, and I tell them, watch those cartoons. You know, watch, it's all in threes, you know, the story arc and so on, and you can get a lot because those things do, they hold true to the storylines and story arc and characters and so on. So it's very simplified,
right.
Obviously, but it holds true.
They maybe broke it down for children in a little bit way, but, you know, even a lot of stuff like Looney Tunes and this and that, very much adult when you go back and listen to it now. It's like, I didn't get half that stuff as a kid. I just thought it was cool that Scooby-Doo was running around solving stuff and was all scared, you know. But Bugs Bunny, I mean, heck, you know, I mean, adults were writing that for children, but they were writing that for adults too, and you can always catch that in there.
You know, the way I look at it, I think they were writing it for themselves. They must have sat there and just laughed like hell. You know, you think about the Roadrunner, you know, and the Acme Anvil products and all this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really funny stuff. And I go back, you know, like I said, I'm 69 years old, so I can remember Cecil and Beanie on television, you know, a little black and white puppet show. It had to cost about $12 to put the whole thing on. And, you know, the double entendres and so on, my parents would walk through the room and listen to it a minute and laugh, and I didn't know what they were laughing at. You know, it didn't seem that funny to me, whatever they happened to be laughing at. But, you know, so I go way back, and you know, maybe I should have done my homework a little bit more, but I was an addict addicted to, you know, those types of shows, and still am. I watch Turner Classic Movies, you know.
Right. I mean, they just had some great ones on, you know, American Movie Classics with all the Halloween stuff that was out, and then Turner Classic Movies. I mean, they got some great black and whites out there. And, you know, it's the same thing that ties into your book. I mean, you know, you bringing those great characters, and because they had to be such extremely well-written, well-scripted movies back then to be enjoyable, where now they don't have to be as well-written because they have all the special effects. I mean, you know, I haven't seen the movie Avatar, so I can't bank on it at all. But, you know, I can't say anything bad about it. But, you know, half the movie, everybody comes out and says, "Oh my God, it was the greatest movie ever because the graphics were just so great." Well, was the story then good? I mean, I already knew the story before I walked in. I haven't even seen it, but I already know how the story was, and I don't find that interesting anymore.
Exactly. You know,
so they haven't done, and cartoons is the same way. You can turn on Saturday morning cartoons, and I still would watch cartoons, but I watch Boomerang because those cartoons were well written because they had to be. But now, you know, they don't have to be well written. They just have to be put on TV, and little kids have to watch them.
They have to be loud. They have to have a lot of
colors,
things flashing at you.
Yeah, there's no plot anymore. There's no one to have fun with and follow.
No, exactly. When I go to the movie rental, they have a place over here not too far away that sells movies, and before they had Netflix and so on, and I'd walk in there every week and buy two or three of the old 1940s movies or whatever, and the guy behind the counter one day says, "You know, Jeff, you're in here all the time buying these movies, but you never buy the new ones. You're always buying these old ones. Why is that? What do the old ones have that the new ones don't have?" And I said, "They had one thing. They had writers."
Exactly.
And when you look at, for example, Double Indemnity, okay, Barbara Stanwyck, Fred McMurray, it was based on a novel by James M. Cain, And frankly, the novel wasn't that good, but Billy Wilder hired Raymond Chandler to rewrite the script and bring it up to their standards. And at the end of the movie, after the they showed the movie at a premiere down in Westwood, you know, the places down there. And the studio invited Billy Wilder, obviously, and Chandler and James M. Cain. And Cain is sitting here watching this movie, which is now a flashback, voiceover, all this stuff, location films. And about halfway through the movie, he realizes that these guys had made him a very famous man, because the movie is so good, so much better than his book. And of course, after the film was over at the party, Cain walked up to Raymond Chandler to shake his hand and congratulate him on how much he's improved his book. And Chandler wouldn't talk to him. He says, "Why don't you go take some writing lessons?" You know, he was a grumpy old man. But Faulkner wrote Chandler's Big Sleep. You know, he had a hand in that. So they had writers in those days.
Yes, they did. I mean, and I think that they still have, you know, and they have fabulous, wonderful writers today. I think the only problem is now it is so much more difficult to find them, because the avenues out there for self-publishing, which, you know, I have no problem with and whatnot, it's the editing part that you lose if you don't have an editor to help you out. So then people just say, "Oh, that's a great book, and I edit it, and I think it's good." They pay their money, they self-publish it, they put it on the Kindle or whatnot. So now people have to sift through more and more things to try to find those authors, because the publishing world has changed so much.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we try to help bring the authors here to the forefront, you know, with a magazine like yourself, so people know that this is an excellently written book, and they're not, you know, and that, you know, when they spend their, you know, $14.95 or whatever it is, they know they're going to get a quality product. They don't have a problem spending it, because I don't think people have a problem spending, you know, the $22 on a hardcover, or the $9.99 on a paperback, or the $14 on a Kindle, as long as they know they get their money's worth. And that's
absolutely
the problem today.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and it's not
they
only
get their money's worth when they get your book, and that's a great thing.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, the funny part about it is, just as you said, in the old days they had editors at the big houses. You know, Simon & Schuster, the famous editor over there was a guy by the name of Michael Korda. Okay, and he worked with Robert Gottlieb, for example, on a book. Everybody knows the book Catch-22. Mm-hmm. And Catch-22 came into the publishing house in a box with papers, loose papers, things stuck together and so on. And these guys put that book together, these two gentlemen. Today, they get a manuscript. They don't like it. It's gone. They're not going to spend the money that it takes to redo a book. So, anybody out there that wants to write a book, number one suggestion, find yourself an editor. You know, a real editor, not a friend that's taken an English course or whatever. Find a professional and work with that professional. I work with a guy by the name of Mike Sirota. He's edited three of my books, and we have a great relationship. But it can be a little brutal. I mean, you can spend, you know, hours and hours crafting a scene and send it out. I send three chapters at a time to him, and then he comes back with his comments or whatever. And he can, you know, he can cut you to ribbons. But it's good,
right?
You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. I mean, you can, you know, and you know, you can send your work to agents and whatnot, as long as it's been edited. But don't think that you're going to write a book and they're just going to fall in love with your synopsis and then they're going to read through it and say, "Oh, we can fix that. We can fix that." They're not going to take the time. If it's well written and they like it and this and that, then they might go through and say, "Okay, maybe we have to cut out like 50 pages to try to," because then they want to look at it how to make it more sellable, because they know you can write, but now they have to look at it and say, how are we going to make money at it? That's when they begin to start editing it, because they need to try to understand if it's a 650-page book, it's like you're going to lose a lot of – just like, you know, Alan was just on. I don't know if you heard. His original manuscript was 500. He had to knock it down to 3. He had to cut 200 pages out because it's difficult to sell a 500-page book.
Absolutely. You know, in this day and age, I know that my publisher just signed – I don't know if I should say this or not, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
Yeah, do it.
What the heck. They just signed a woman, Anna Lee Waldo. Okay, now she hasn't been published in a number of years, but one of her books in the 1980s sold about 8 million copies. Okay, now get this. That book, it's a historical romance type of thing. And she's an excellent writer, obviously. Mm-hmm. But that book is 1,500 pages, and it still sold that amount. Her latest book, I think these guys are going to publish it. It's going to be about 750 pages. But that's very rare. And it has been thoroughly edited, again, by Mike Sirota. So, you know, today they tell me, you know, this is what they say. They say that today's audience has the attention span of a fruit fly. So if you can't keep your story moving fast, bam, 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 and, you know, grab their attention, and you better grab their attention within the first page or so, otherwise forget about it.
What were we talking about? No, I'm just joking. Go ahead.
Yeah, all right, exact snore yawn.
I'm sorry. Oh, okay, go ahead. I got it now.
Yeah, right. But that's the way it is. And if you look at, books that sell in the mystery category, they're very well written. Michael Conley, I just finished his book. It was a great book, and he's right to the point. There's nothing, you know. I talked to a writer, Coleman, I believe it was, and he was giving a talk, and one of the people in the audience said, you don't waste a lot of pages describing flower pots like they did in the, 18th, 19th century. And he says, no, he said, for example, he said, right now, I want you to open your mind, and I'm going to say a word of English manor house. And everybody just kind of paused. And he says, now, everybody in the room here knows exactly what that looks like. We have television, we have magazines, we have pictures, newspapers. We don't have to go page after page to describe it. We can just give a hint about what it is, and as you're reading the book, that image will come in your mind. But in the 19th century, say you're sitting in Nebraska someplace on a corn farm, you would have no idea what an English manor house looked like or what it was. So the novelists in those days would spend pages describing it. Well, you can't do that today.
Right.
As much as you would like to show off your fancy prose, forget about it.
I know. Well, everybody, our time here is up for, this has been flying through. The book is called Detour to Murder. It's a film novel by who we've been speaking with, Jeff Sherritt. You can visit Jeff on his website at jeffsherratt.com to find out more about Detour to Murder and be able to follow him on his new Facebook fan page, which he has at the very top. And he also has Mike Sirota's website up there, who he's been so graciously talking about as his editor. So, Jeff, great stuff. Thank you so much.
You,
we could have gone on for a long time. I mean, I'm just sitting here. We're just talking away. It's been great. So I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you. And if I ever get out your way, we'll stop at Starbucks. I'll buy you a latte, and I'll spend an hour.
I'm up here in Calabasas, so you let me know when.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
All right, Jeff. You have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was Jeff Sherritt. We were just talking to there. Wrote the book Detour to Murder, and it's one of those books that, like I said, he explained it, very, very well, and it's one of those books that you should go out and definitely check out. Our first guest we had on there was Alan Dershowitz, and Alan wrote The Trials of Zion, definitely another book to go check out. So when you're talking Christmas gifts and things like that, you want to put your copy of Suspense Magazine and the stocking stuffer, and also you should pick up these books. But in the December issue, we're going to let you know which books to put in those stocking stuffers, so make sure you check it out and make sure to go pick up your copy of Suspense Magazine today on newsstands. I want to thank everybody again. Friday we are going to be on the early show. It's going to be in the morning. So until Friday morning, we will see you with David Balducci at 8 a.m. Pacific time. Thank you so much, everyone. Have a great night. See you on Friday morning.